Good morning.
Good morning.
Last week, as Helen and I were driving home after the conversation about the woman at the well and Savasti, the young boy whom the Buddha spoke to in the forest, Helen pointed out to me that I did not tell the full story of the woman at the well, nor the story of Savasti and Buddha. I got up to the halfway point and stopped, which is a curious thing. And as a counselor type person, I wondered why I would get to a middle of a story and stop and change the subject. So this past couple weeks, I've been pondering that and have included that in my meditative journey, and have gone from remembering some stories in my history to the genre of the zombie movies and trying to understand how the zombie movies and stories from my history, how could that possibly relate to me stopping in the middle of two stories up here in front of the church. But somehow they're related. And so I've been working to try to understand how they're related, because if I brought it up in front of people and I have questions and Helen had questions, maybe others might have questions. And I got to thinking about the two stories, and in both those stories are about people who were oppressed and people who believed something about themselves that were false beliefs, such as the woman at the well had a belief about herself that she could not talk to Jesus because he was a Jew and she was a Samaritan and there's a racial difference and she's not good enough to be spoken to. She is of a class that is invisible. And so I stopped there. And at the story about Savasti, he's an 11-year-old boy whose father and mother had died. And as an 11-year-old boy, he was taking care of two or three younger siblings. And somebody in a community who owned water buffaloes gave him charge of the water buffaloes so he could make some money in order to feed his family. And at the same time, in his culture, there are four classes, and he wasn't even in any of the classes. He was an untouchable, and that was ingrained so much in him that when he saw the Buddha in the woods meditating and he was inspired to run toward the Buddha, he stopped himself from coming toward the Buddha, because if you're an untouchable, you can't touch anybody else, because if you touch anybody else, you would be beaten. And the person that you touch would have to go cleanse themselves because they would be polluted. And so when he stopped himself as he was coming toward the Buddha stepped toward him, and then Savasti stepped back, and the Buddha said, "Well, what's going on? Why are you doing that?" And he said, "I'm afraid to touch you because I don't want to pollute you." This is an 11-year-old boy. That led me to the phrase colonization of the mind, which led me to the movies of the zombies, because the movies of the zombies are about colonization of the mind and how we're zombies, according to the author of that movie, or we're afraid to look at how we might be unconsciously contributing to our own oppression, how we internalize our own oppression, just as the woman at the well did and just like Savasti did. That we do it to ourselves. So I got to thinking about that, and a memory came to me. And in my training process, there's a spiritual growth process we go through. And primarily, that spiritual growth process goes something like this, that we are to reflect on our lives to see if anything has happened in our lives that could interfere with our present-day ministry or our present-day relationships. And if we discover something that could interfere, well, we're to work with that and clean that up. A brief example of that would be when I was 10, my parents divorced, and one of my first clinical experiences, I was talking to a 10-year-old boy who was in a psychiatric hospital,
And his father had just died. And so when I have that conversation, I've got to take it to a supervisor. And my supervisor asked me, from my written account, "Gregory, why do you change the subject every time the 10-year-old boy wants to talk about the loss of his father?" And I said, "I don't change the subject." And then he pointed to the paper that I turned in. He said, "Indeed, you do change the subject." See? Because of my unresolved grief and my unresolved difficulties in my own life, I was not able to bridge that gap to talk to that 10-year-old boy about his pain and to help him. So my history was getting in the way. And so I know that to be true. So, and they prize that the students who take their time to reflect on that. And sometimes we do that so much in that process, we can get stuck in it because we get an affirmation for it. And we can get stuck in it. And I remember one time I was sitting in a group, and this woman, supervisor, Kathleen Davis, as I was talking, she said to me, "Gregory, you are more than the hurtfulness from your history. You are more than the dysfunction from your past. You are more than that. Somehow, because of my history," and I wasn't quite sure how I was doing it, but I was limiting myself, and I was captured by my history. What Jesus was doing in talking to the woman at the well, he was saying to her, "You are more than this woman who is steeped in shame. You are more than a woman who is racially oppressed. You are a human being." And as we talk, that conversation moved to celebrating life again. You are more than what you believe about yourself. What the Buddha was saying to Savasti, "You are more than this untouchable. You are more than commitment to taking care of your siblings, and that's going to be your life lot. You are more than somebody who thinks that they're... You are more than that." So Kathleen Davis was my Jesus. She was my Buddha. She would say, "You are more than that." And I've got to thinking about that and why I stopped in the middle of those stories, because at those moments in time when we realize we've been captured by beliefs from our history, and to move past those beliefs from our history is a painful process. Have you ever gone on the internet and looked at websites from counselors? And if you find an honest one, the counselor will say if you engage in this process, you're going to experience anxiety, you might experience some depression, you're going to experience some discomfort if you engage in this process of moving to spiritual health. That's possibly why I stopped in the middle of that story. Because it reminded me in my life of somebody saying to me, "I was more than the hurtfulness from my history. I was more than that." And today, myself and as a church, we say to the people here, "You are more than what you struggle with. You are more than the hurtfulness from your past. You are more than if you struggle with alcohol and drugs. You are more than an alcoholic. You are more than a drug addict. If you struggle with some kind of shame-based negative self-belief system like the woman at the well, you are more than that. You are a human being that has more potential to celebrate life than that." And that is what both Buddha, Jesus, and Kathleen Davis had to say to me. We are more than that. And if we look back at the story of the woman at the well, I think we find something very interesting. Because when Jesus was talking to her, and I think when I read that story, he's kind of rude. He's at the well, she comes to the well, and I've read this in several translations, and he says, "Give me a drink." Pretty abrupt and rude. She says, back to them, "Who are you to ask me to give you a drink, you being a Jew, me being a Samaritan?" So right away, their engagement is conflictual. They're at odds with one another. And then he says, "Well, if you were to ask me to give you a drink, you would have the drink of everlasting water and everlasting life." And then she says to him, "What, are you greater than Jacob, who had this well 500 years ago? Who are you to be saying what you're saying?" And what I realized at that point is she is anchored in her history. Because as this man is talking to her, she can compare the men and the women from her history to what this man is saying. She reflects on her history to what this man is saying. So when this man says something, she just doesn't take it for the here and now. She goes back to her memory banks and saying, "Who is this guy? And how can I?" And compares him to persons in her history. She's reflecting. And when I realized that, I understood something about the Hebrew faith and Hebrew philosophy, is that one of the gifts the Hebrews give us is a reflective consciousness. The Hebrews reflect on their relationship between them as a people and their God, and they work to make meaning of that. And what we see in this conversation with the woman at the well is that reflective process in action. So that what happens in the here and now, there's a reflective process on the history to help us make sense of the here and now, and to keep a balance about what's going on in the here and now to help us determine what truth is. So she was saying to him, "Wait a minute, who are you? I know my history. This is Jacob's well, and Jacob gave us the gift of this water. This was a gift of God, and you're telling me you can give me greater water that was in here?" And she finally says to him, "Yeah, I'll take some of your water so I don't have to come out to the well anymore, because it's a hot walk to get out to this well." So she's really giving him a hard time. She's staying literal. And I was trying to think of that reflective consciousness today and what it might mean for us today, and to see if our nation and we as a people are a reflective people. And this gift that we've got from this Hebrew theology, this Hebrew philosophy, do we use it, and are we active as a nation that many people would say that we're anchored in the Abraham faith? But are we? Does this woman at the well have something to say to us when we engage in people who talk in the present? Does she have something to teach us that we are to grab stuff from our history to compare to what's going on in the here and now? The first thing that came to my mind, I'm going to say, and sometimes that's a mistake, but I'll say it anyway, and it's something that John Stewart, a comedian from television, pointed out that I'll use. And if Richard Cheney was at the well, and Richard Cheney ran up against this woman at the well, and Richard Cheney would say to this woman at the well, "Yeah, we're going to go to war because these people are a threat to us, and I think that as a nation this would be the right thing for us to do." She would say to him, "Wait a minute, I can remember somebody that worked for the Defense Department 10, 13 years ago who said we should not go into war, because if we go into war, it would be a quagmire, and it would be a mess, and it would drag our country, and it would drain us of funds, it would interfere with our domestic spending, and we should not do that. And I remember that from history, Mr. Cheney, and it was you who said it." But 10 years later, you're saying something completely different. That's the reflection, meaning-making process of knowing our history. This is a woman that knew her history. So when somebody said something to her, she had something to go back to say, "Wait a minute, when I'm comparing to you what I know the truth about my history, it's not making sense to me." So we as a nation, the majority of us, I would say, don't practice this reflective meaning-making process, because when somebody would say something to us in the here and now, we would take what they said and we would run it through our filters of history to see if it makes sense. And if it doesn't make sense, we would say, "What are you talking about?" And if you remember back that 7 years ago or so, that when the people that were reflective and meaning-making said, "No, this has the smacks of Vietnam. This has the feeling, and this has the air of something that's really dangerous." That those people were shamed and made fun of and called unpatriotic. The woman at the well teaches us something. She teaches us how to engage a voice that's bringing new information. And she says to this man, Jesus, "Well, so far, you haven't really said anything to me, because you say you've got living water, and I say, give it to me so I don't have to come back to the well." She's saying, "I'm not really taking you serious yet," is what she's saying. "Because you haven't really bumped out of this history check that I'm running upon you." And then he talks to her personally. And he shares with her his understanding of her personal life. Issues of five husbands, issues of shame. I mean, he just talks about the five husbands, what it's reading. But when she runs back to town to tell her town folk what she says, she said, "This is a man that knew everything about me." And it somehow, in that knowing everything about her, did not put her off. She was able to listen. She was able to hear what he had to say, to the point where she could let go of the dysfunction of her past and celebrate life again. It wasn't an innocent conversation, one way, "You take what I give you and celebrate life." It was an engagement. "You have something to say to me. Well, who are you to speak to me?" she says to him. And he tells her who he is. And she listens. And he uses the language of her faith. "I am God the Father," worships here, will worship here. He uses her language. And he eventually does something else that's very curious. And I don't really know what to make of it yet. He talks about the Father being God. And then he shifts and he says, "God is spirit." And I really don't know what that's about yet, but I know when that shift of saying Father localized to Jacob's well, Father localized to worship in Jerusalem, that shift to God is spirit and soon God will be worshipped everywhere was part of her listening to him. That in that conversation, for those two people who had a belief in the same God, he shifted and removed the gender from God. I don't know what to make of that at this point, except that that's part of the story. But I also know that that part of the story had meaning to her. And so she somehow shares who she is not rejected, feels affirmed, celebrates life again. She was available to engage in the conversation. She was rooted in her tradition, and yet she had wings to be set free, the song that we sing in the spirit of life. She teaches us that we need to know our history, but at the same time, we need to be engaged in conversation because there is more freedom in this life to have. Savasthi and the story of Buddha is not quite the same. It's not quite the same. They go through this encounter. And when Buddha says to Savasthi, "You're not an untouchable. You're a human being." And Savasthi reports that he says that in such a way, with such a voice tone, that Savasthi's resistance to being touched melts away. So in the Buddha-Savasthi story, we get something different. We get a different quality in the conversation, whereas Jesus and the woman at the well, they're arguing. But over here, Buddha takes a different approach. There's a gentleness to it. And have you ever, and I think about, have you ever heard a voice tone that can put you at ease? You ever heard a voice tone that can set you on edge? Right. Do we know the voice tones that set other people on edge? Do we know the voice tones that set people at ease? Sure, sure we do. Do you know people that flinch when you move? And you see him go back. Well, Savosky was a flincher, because as he took care of the water buffaloes, if the water buffaloes came back hungry, he would be beaten. The colonizing of Savosty's mind, for him to believe that he was an untouchable, was worked through physical force. One thing when you look at, and I was thinking of Savosty, because he was an orphan, and I know that in the Christian sacred text that pure religion is taking care of the orphan and widows. And so I started searching that out, and I was looking in a study guide, and was looking up fatherless, and it was used 41 times, fatherless, and Savosty was certainly fatherless. And each time that it's used, it's, you are to take care of the fatherless. That is pure religion. You are to be kind. And generally, it's fatherless and widows. And so I said, well, I'm going to going to speak to Unitarian Universalists, and if I look up fatherless, I better look up motherless to keep myself in balance. All right? And so, keeping myself balanced, I did. Motherless is not used. Just fatherless. And I've got to thinking a bit more about that. And but isn't that the truth of it? That how whatever social configuration we have, however that works, the poorest among us, single moms, not single dads with kids, single moms, that's the poorest among us. But yet we have, through our faith tradition, a core to our economic and social justice, a core teaching, right through the Hebrew sacred text, through the Christian sacred text. A backbone of our teaching is taking care of the fatherless and the widows. That's the backbone of our teaching. We're doing a seminar on economic democracy on June 7th. And as a result of going through here, I'm now thinking about talking about the single moms, fatherless widows, that group of people. They're maybe the canaries in the mines for economic democracy. If we're not taking care of the least of these, and I got to thinking more about Savosty, because he didn't have a father and a mother with him, does that give others permission to beat him when he is not good enough? An 11-year-old boy making sure 5 water buffaloes get fed. Not an easy task. Is that what happens in our culture when people can't contribute? I've had this conversation, had it yesterday, as a matter of fact, with somebody at a gathering, and we were trying to figure out how come churches don't have programs for single moms to help out if they're the least of these, you know. And my cynical answer was, there's no money in it. There's no return. You know, you're not going to give here and get something back monetarily. So there's no investment. There's no payoff. You're not going to gather a bunch of people, say, like through issues of abortion or gay marriage, and get people to the voting block to vote. You're not going to, you know, you just... It's caring without expectations back. It's caring because it's the right thing to do. You know, I searched a little more on that, and trying to, and I know there's statistics and such about the fatherless and orphans and kids in single parent homes. And if I remember right, 85% of the people in prison, single homes or something like that, in a juvenile delinquent center, it's the same kind of percentage that. When we don't take care of the least of these, when we feel we have permission to beat, to oppress, to abuse, to enslave, the most vulnerable, how does that influence and what does that do to our society? And we know if 85% of the people in prison and in juvenile detention centers, we know that the colonization of that person's mind, being a vulnerable person, we know that how they think about themselves and how they're going to operate in this world, this is where they end up. And in the story of Savasti, we get a similar picture. If his mind is colonized strong enough, he will perpetually believe he is an untouchable and he will behave himself accordingly for the rest of his life. But if he gets to be 18 years old and he says, forget this, I'm tired of being beaten, and he strikes back, he ends up in prison because he didn't behave himself. And that's what happens. So Siddhartha, the Buddha, says to him in a gentle voice, and this has really struck me, and then touched him gently on his head. And the story reports, it's the first time Savasti can remember ever being touched as an untouchable. So Savasti hangs in there. He listens. He receives what the Buddha had to give. The woman at the well receives what Jesus had to give. I hung in there and I received what Kathleen Davis had to give. How is it that we bring ourselves to the place where we can receive what people have to give to us? Savasti was 11, and the Buddha stayed within that community a while, and he taught in that community a while, and the first people he taught were children. And then after he left, he told Savasti, I will come back 10 years from now, and I will retrieve you, and you will go, and if you choose to, you can go off to one of the communities where we teach people about spiritual growth. And he did. And Savasti becomes a monk and becomes part of that community and breaks out of his class self-colonization, breaks out of his class structure. What strikes me about both those stories is that we can be more than we believe about ourselves. We can be more than whatever this genre of movies talking about zombies, whatever that is. I can be more than that. The theologians at the same time this zombie movie was coming out started talking about living suicides. The living dead. Saying that we were the living dead. What the woman at the well and what Savasti teach us not to be the living dead is to be able to hear others and what they say and discern who they are. And if we discern that they're worth listening to, maybe our lives can be transformed. And if we have the potential to transform our lives, then we're not zombies. I'm voting for that. Then we're not the living dead. I'm voting for that. And when somebody says, we're going to do this, I want to be studied good enough. I want to know my history good enough that I can say, wait a minute, we've heard that before. No, wait a minute, we've heard that before. That's what the woman at the well teaches us to do. You're saying this, wait a minute, are you greater than Jacob through this well and his children and generations have drank from this well, and you're saying you're greater than that? She's saying, no, so far, no, you're not. She teaches us to ask the question and to know our history, and at the same time, she's available to change. Savasti knew his history. His mind was colonized that he was an untouchable. Yet, when the message was just right, when the voice tone was just right, when the other person was willing to reach out and touch him, he was available to change. Our work today, pulling the wisdom from these two stories, is to know our history and be solidly rooted in knowing our history so we know how to ask questions, and when we hear something, we know what to bump it up against to check it out. But at the same time, be free enough of mind to be available for change. That's what these stories are about, to be available for change.